All right. So I have three kids, Elgin, a 10-year-old, Cora, a 4-year-old, and Haven, who's one. Haven has basically got three words down, and one of them is dada. And I was talking to him this morning on FaceTime, which since I was gone the last few days, he's now allowed to hold the phone, which is dangerous, but it's insured. And he was like, dada, 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 da. And then he shakes it so that you're getting kind of nauseous looking at the camera, but then like you're my child and cute, so I don't want to look away, but it also might hurl. So you're kind of trying to stare next to the camera so he sees your face and keeps saying dada because it's cute, but not look so you don't hurl. That was my experience this morning. Cora, on the other hand, the 4-year-old, she has learned all sorts of words so she can tell me when she thinks I'm wrong. Right? She learned the word no before mom and before dad, and she's used it really, really well. And I got a call yesterday from Cora, and she goes, dad, mom says I have to talk to you about this. About what, Cora? Daddy, you know I love you. What do you want? Do you want a pony? Because she's asked me for a pony recently. No. And she goes, I don't want that. I need new princess outfits. I only have three princess outfits. And I need more princess outfits. And mommy said we could go get one if you said I could go spend the money. Well, do you have any of your allowance left? That's why I called you, Daddy. And I said, I think you might want to wait. Think of it as an opportunity to mature. No, I want now. And and she just keeps telling me I'm wrong. Daddy, I think you really love me. I'm going to move that there. I'm going to injure myself. Now, Elgin, he's got words. He's learned things, he's had experiences, and recently, he not only told me he was wrong, or told me I was wrong, but after I talked to Jesus, he was right. And this story, the story of Samuel and Eli, is a story of what a tradition gives the young, what that tradition looks like in mentorship and what transformation it is we're really going for. Now, the other day when this experience happened, when Elgin told me I was wrong, I talked to Jesus. Jesus is like, your son's right. You got to get over it. Then I called one of my friends because I think maybe God wants to use the voice of my friends to reinforce that I was correct. And he's an elderly gentleman, and he said, well, you know, there's two different ways to look at this trip. Either you have such horrible hearing, God is going to use a 10-year-old to tell you you're an ignoramus and to get back on track. Or you aren't that bad of a parent. Sometimes good parenting means your children expect more from you, a more faithful witness to the love of God than you do for yourself. So maybe you should repent and then pat yourself on the back for not blowing it as a dad. Because your kid heard the word of the Lord even when it didn't come in your voice. So the context for this text is important to get. It's about the religious tradition of Israel. It's about the what of religion. It's also about mentorship, the how, the relationships for that tradition's given life. And then it's about the transformation that takes place when those individuals who learn things about God and learn how to follow God actually encounter the living God. And as a parent, as a minister, you hope all the words you use and the activities you do, all the knowing and doing, leads to an encounter with God that words don't even make sense for. And that's what this text is about. And it comes at an important time in the life of Israel Because God made a covenant with Moses and told Aaron, the first priest, I'm going to make you an eternal priesthood. So your kids, obviously, will be the next priest, and then it'll keep going, and we'll always have priests around. Then it gets to Eli, who inherits a tradition and is the world's worst parent. Like, his kids, when it talks about them, I forget the line it uses. It's something about, like, in Hebrew, they brought in sacrifices from other idols into the tent of God. So it's not like they're just practicing idolatry. They don't care. And they brought in prostitutes from another God's temple into the tent with the Ark of the Covenant and employed them. I know there are children in the room. I didn't want to say, you know. So, it's not like Eli was doing bad parenting and raising kind of boring priests. He was checked out and was doing nothing as a parent and not very good as a priest. And so Eli is failing. The sons of Eli have been judged. Chapter 2, in the beginning of this book, a prophet comes from out of town, a hillbilly prophet. He doesn't even have good Hebrew grammar, so he probably had a hardcore Southern drawl. And he says, Eli, your sons are bemoaning and defaming God, and they're going to die before you. Well, this was a preacher from out of town, so we know what he did. He ignored him and acted like he wasn't speaking on behalf of God and just moved on. So this traveling prophet moves on, but you know the word landed because Eli, at the end of the story, insists Samuel tell him what God said. So that's the context when you hear the text say this. Now the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord under Eli, the word of the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were not widespread. Now you could hear that and think maybe God was just hanging around going, I'm kind of bored, I'm going to take a few years off. Or sometimes the word of the Lord is rare and visions aren't seen because no one's awake to listen. And if Eli's the one supervising the souls of the people, it shouldn't be surprised. And the text, as if the details are picked just to explain the dire situation, says, at that time, Eli, whose eyesight had begun to grow dim so that he could not see, was lying down in his room. I read this kind of like one of those scrolls in the Star Wars movies. And this is more of an Empire Strikes Back scroll where it's getting really bad and you're like, no one's even hearing the word of the Lord. Or, where is Luke? We haven't seen him in years. What's going to happen? And then the text says, and the lamp of God has not yet gone out. And you're like, do-do-do-do. Maybe the last Jedi is not the last Jedi. Maybe the Force is going to reawaken and it's going to take new forms. I mean, maybe the ancient religion of the Jedi was really getting at something that's true that should not be captured, namely in Jedi religion, but it actually embodies and invites people into a spiritual relationship with all the living things and bring goodness in the world, even on that crazy, crazy little ship called the Millennium Falcon. I have a little theory about Jedi religion that I'm going to not talk about right now. But interesting enough, there are large parallels to this story to episode 7 and 8. So if you want to talk about that afterwards, we could do it. So there is Samuel. He's laying down in the temple of the Lord where the Ark of God was, and the lamp had not quite gone out. The symbolism setting up this story is thick. And you're sitting there going like, so what is the chance anyone's going to hear? And who is it whose mom, Samuel's mom, dedicates him to the Lord, and then she probably got gossip at church about what the preacher's kids are doing. It's like, dear God, I can't believe I left him with him. I mean, have you seen what his preacher's kids are doing, bringing those ladies from that other temple into the holy? Luckily, Samuel's mom doesn't really tell us what she thought about her decision afterwards, but there's Sam. He's helping an old guy read who doesn't really know what to do, and the light hasn't gone out. And then what happens? The text says, Samuel, Samuel. And Samuel says, here I am. So he ran to Eli. And then it happens again. He hears the Lord calling, but all Samuel knows is that that voice sounds like Eli, and he runs. And Eli says, "I did not call you, my son. Go lie down again." The text says, now Samuel did not yet know the Lord. He knew about the Lord. He just didn't know the Lord. So the Lord of the Lord had not yet been revealed to him. The Lord again called to Samuel a third time. He got up, went to Eli, and said, "Hey, I'm right here. You called." Eli perceived that the Lord was calling the boy. Therefore, Eli said to Samuel, "Go lie down. If he calls you, you shall say, 'Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening.'" So Samuel went and lay down in his place. This moment is like Eli's last moment of positive contribution to the history of Israel. You know, he stunk as a dad and a priest, so much so at the end of this story. Like two chapters later, God's like, "You know that promise of an eternal priesthood by biological descent? I'm reevaluating. I think we could read that passage less literally, more metaphorically. Maybe eternal priesthood are those who have the form of faith of Aaron and are not necessarily his biological descendants," which is convenient, because in the early Baptists, the argument against the other reformers for the priesthood of believer, meaning that you can read and interpret the text on your own and should come to faith as an adult, goes all the way back to this. The priesthood of the believer is not whose kid you are and you got baptized before you knew it, but it's who you were when you heard the word of the Lord and came out. That's a Reformation exegesis aside. I said that because I owed student loans for my PhD, and that's why I knew that. So Eli's old and blind. He's tapped out. He's like, "I don't even want to tell my kids it's a bad idea to bring the ladies of the evening in here. I'm just done." And what is his last moment? What is his last act of fame? He looks at Samuel and goes, "Oh, junk. Maybe God actually is speaking. Maybe something is going on." And Eli coaches Samuel and says, "Listen, if God calls again, respond. And respond by saying, 'Your servant is listening.'" Eli mentors Samuel to learn a posture of obedience, even though he's failing to be fully obedient in his own situation. Which is good news, parents. You know, do as I say and as I pretend I did when I was younger, if I haven't told you all the stories yet, you know? That Eli facilitates Samuel taking steps of faithfulness into the life and heart of God that he is scared to go. But he knows that the proper response for an encounter with God is one that acknowledges the voice of God and takes a posture of obedience. So when my family is really from Arkansas, but my grandfather, George Hiram Fuller I, was in the Air Force 28 years. He was the Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force, so I didn't spend time in Arkansas except for family reunions. And when we went back to Gurdon, Arkansas, we went to Harmony Baptist Church, a primitive Baptist church. They're like so Calvinist, the Calvinists are uncomfortable with how Calvinist they are. You'll be at a funeral, and they won't say that they're of the elect, because that might offend God's holiness. And you're like, that's awkward. You're like, wouldn't like God so love the world? Maybe. I hope your aunt is among the elect. Yeah, like, you know, anyway, the very, very depressing funerals. Well, we would go back every so often, and my grandfather is the youngest of 13. So my, like, great-aunts were significantly older than him. And we were going for a ride through town, the area of Arkansas my family had been in for a long, 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 long time. And we pass the pharmacy, our last name's on it, And we pass, like, half the town has Fuller or Thomerson, which are both Fuller family names, on it. And then we get to a hardware store. It's like Fuller Hardware Store. I didn't know the Fullers had a hardware store. Whose is it? And my Aunt Ea, that's not a real name, turns around to me, straight face, not being sarcastic, and said, "Well, I don't know what they told you at school, but some families, like the Fuller families, treated their slaves so nice they kept our last name. And that's why it's there." And my grandpa sees my face starting to respond. And I'm like, "But I just..." He looks at me like that, you know, from the front seat, giving, you know, the mirrors right there. He shoots it. And all of a sudden, that face young recruits in the Air Force had when they thought they would rather go to hell than do what he said, but then they changed their mind, that face shined, and I said nothing. We get out of the car, and she walks into Aunt Ruby's house, and Papaw grabs me. He puts his face down in my thing like this, and he looks at me, and he says, "I served in an integrated military, and it took that to teach me my family's racist as hell, boy. She's old, she's going to die, so you don't got to make a scene right now. Sometimes Jesus uses death to move us along." And I was like, "All right." And so I go in. I just remember that later. I tell the story to my dad after I'm home because I was hanging out with my grandfather. And he's like, "Yeah, I'm really sorry about that. You know? Everyone has a history, but we got to learn to deal with it." Now, Papaw recognized something. And if I told you his whole story with Atsy, Atsy was the one who invited my dad in, and she treated my dad as her son from fifth grade until his junior year of college, because Papaw was gone to Vietnam. And Atsy was the one who drove him around to see all of his family members every birthday, every Christmas, and every Father's Day where his dad was gone. And he said she was doing God's work when she took care of my son because I wasn't there. You can be faithful without being fully faithful. And he would always joke about it. He's like, "I ain't Jesus, you know? Faithfulness is not about batting 1,000 unless you're the Lord. You can get into the Hall of Fame for batting 300, which means you have a 70% fail rate." The text goes on and says, "Now the Lord came and stood there, calling as before, 'Samuel, Samuel,' and Samuel said, 'Speak, for your servant is listening.' And the Lord said to Samuel, 'See, what I am about to do in Israel will make both ears of anyone who hears tingle.'" I have no idea what that means, but it definitely sounds exciting. And the idea of God saying it is funny. Like, if you just said it with a low, raspy voice, it would feel awkward, right? "On that day, I will fulfill against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I have told him that I am about to punish his house forever." And he goes on and says, that whole everlasting priesthood, I'm done with it. And just get ready, Samuel, because you're going to have to step up. Well, when he gets done with this encounter with God, the text says Samuel laid there until morning. Yeah, you know he's going to ask you what God said, and God's like, "I wasn't joking when the hillbilly prophet came. You're going to see your children die, and you deserve it because you suck as a dad and a priest, and I take back the eternal priesthood. So maybe you should get ready for this." That's crazy. And God in the text says, "And don't tell him to go in and try to make sacrifices. It ain't working." Because you know that's what a priest's fallback is. Or just like a husband who hasn't listened for the 10th time. Like, "Do you understand what I'm saying, Tripp?" "Yeah, I'm sorry. For what? You know, like what we're talking about. When Todd's like, talks about it, his ears working, Alicia jokes, she's like, Trip, I really think it's good. Like every 6 times you see a counselor, we spend money for you to listen to what I said 6 months ago. And that's why I'm never going to be in charge of the temple of the Lord. So Samuel's sitting there laying until morning going, look, I've never even encountered God myself. I've been sitting in this temple for years. God sat there and called my name 3 times, and I thought God's voice was Eli's voice, and now I'm supposed to tell Eli he's going to watch his kids die. God changes the mind about how that priesthood thing works. Oh my goodness, I'm laying down in the temple. And you could just see him like crashed. And the day begins, he opens it up, and Samuel, it says, was afraid to tell the vision to Eli. And Eli said, what was it he told you? And then Eli goes on and says, if you don't tell me, I hope the same thing happens to you that God said is going to happen to me. So Samuel told him everything and hid nothing from him. Then he said, Eli, it is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him. How many of you remember the first time your parents weren't perfect? No kids raised their hand. That's good. Hi, yours did? Oh, all of Todd's children raising their hands. See, I don't remember the first time I thought that about my parents, but I definitely remembered Elgin telling me. And I used to read this story, and I always have read it the first 35 years of my life as I'm Samuel. I'm this young person who's committed to the Lord, and I'm ready to say yes to God and service. And I'll even tell those old people where I think they're wrong because God told me to. And it's not personal, it's biblical. Samuel, much like me and a lot of us here, we're dedicated to God from our birth. You're in a church, you hear the stories, you learn the knowledge of God. You learn to love the stories and the people that are around mentoring you and things, and yet there is a moment where knowledge about God is transformed by an encounter with God. Being part of a tradition, a community, and finding within it amazing mentors who teach you the language of obedience. But they can't do it for you, and that knowledge doesn't substitute for knowing God oneself. But it does help us situate ourselves towards faith. Right? All the students who are going on camp this weekend, and it's like their next to last one or their last one, are going to tell all the seventh graders, you need to come every week, every summer, because this community is going to be with you throughout that entire process of coming of age and becoming an adult. And some days, like fourth day into camp, when you've sleep deprived, and then you lapse into honesty and say the secrets you've been keeping all year. And then there are these people that love you that aren't related to you that are say that God loves you and empowers you. And you bless them and all that. You can't do that if you don't put yourself in the right situation in a community that says our job is grace. And then it happens. But as a minister, you're there. And as friends and peers, you're there. So they actually get to encounter God. And Eli, despite how bad a job he was as a parent and a minister, facilitated Samuel getting to that place. In fact, Samuel heard God 3 times, and he thought it was Eli. A lot of you will have encounters with God, and your friends and your mentors and your pastor's voices will get confused with God's, because so many times it's been used. But if you're smart, and you have a mentor that teaches you how to differentiate their voice from God's voice, you can come back and you can challenge them. Eli taught Samuel how to respond to God in a moment of encounter. Speak, for your servant is listening. So Elgin, We moved back to North Carolina from almost 10 years in Los Angeles 6 months ago. So all three of our children are not Southerners like their parents. And Cora started going to preschool at First Baptist in downtown Raleigh. My parents live in downtown, so we were like, it's kind of between where we live and parents live, because part of the reason to moving back is free babysitting and or intergenerational community of support. And Cora's, and First Baptist is on at the end of Hillsborough Street in downtown Raleigh, where the Capitol building and everything is. Like, you have like the Capitol building and First Baptist Church, and it's been there forever. The church is 2 years older than the statue that sits at the end of the main street as you walk on to the Capitol. And I know it because my grandfather walked me around in downtown Raleigh all the time. You walk by all the war memorials, and he tells stories. And his stories are so entertaining, half of it is true. And every time we got to the Vietnam memorial, he would tell us the name of someone who didn't come back and talk about their family he's kept up with since then. And he did it, and he would tell members of our family in each and every war that went by. And I grew up visiting him in downtown Raleigh, and now my parents live there, and we're walking past the same places, but we're pulling out of preschool, having just picked up Cora, and Elgin starts crying. And I'm like, Elgin, what's wrong? Dad, that's just not right. What? Like, dude, you're freaking your sister out, man. And he's like, she can't read. Read what? Did you see what's on that statue? It says, to our Confederate dead. First at Bethel, last at Appomattox. Underneath it was a school classroom, and there are only like three or four of the kids were white. Who's the our, Dad? And it's right in front of the church. They have cannons and a big statue pointing at the church. And it says, our Confederate dead. No wonder the service was so white. Now, I've walked past that statue a million times. We've passed it, my grandfather would say, Hiram Shaw Fuller, you have his name, was a sergeant in the Confederate Army. He was also a Baptist minister. And his side hustle was tasting whiskey. But only part of the family knew that, because he graded it for how much it cost when it came into Girden. And he would tell the stories of the family members, and he never talked about the war specifically, but the lives of the people that were in it. And so when I pass it, I just think of it's another set of stories of people that were in my family, and my son saw it differently, and I was uncomfortable. And so, I started praying about it. And God said, maybe you love parts of your tradition or ignore them that don't need to be there. And I start going through my head, right? And I re-remember the story of Papaw sitting me down and giving me the eye look and going like, Atsy was an amazing woman. She misunderstood this. This is wrong, but she's going to die. And you have a question to ask yourself when the young people of faith call us out as mentors. We can either join what God's doing, or we can be sitting there with God in the Spirit waiting on us to die. And I called my mentor, Elgin Frank Tupper. He was a professor at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and then taught me at Wake Forest. And I told him this story. And he said, and he's 79 years old, retired. And he said, now, Tripp, I don't know if I've told you this. You're up in Mississippi. But my father and mother did not go to my ordination because I said I was not getting ordained with all white hands. I should have told you that story sooner so you didn't embarrass yourself in front of your son. Luckily, you've done a better job parenting than I expected. So what did obedience mean for Samuel? It meant showing up at the place, the tradition, the community, your mentor said you will encounter and hear the voice of God. But it also meant going back to that community and say, God has been trying to do a new thing and I need some priests that are going to listen. What if a successful community of faith, a tradition, and mentorship is marked by them telling us we just don't cut it in parts of our lives? And their pushbacks, and teenagers' pushback does not feel good. Just go, you know, it can be verbose and hyperbolic. But what if in the midst of their criticism and unease with parts of this life that we're giving them is actually the voice of God calling in newness? And what if that tangled brokenness of humanity generation to generation is the very place the Spirit of God has been moving us forward towards a more just and beautiful and gracious community? Can we hear that pushback as a sign? As parents, as mentors, as church leaders. And can we tell them, speak is not just the proper response to God when he calls, but to us, because we need to listen. And can we hear their voice as a call to further fidelity? And may we not respond with the words of Eli, I guess it is the Lord. Let him do whatever seems good to him. Because Eli knew what God was up to and has already said no to being a part of it.